Welcome to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Hello, and welcome to Radio Oldie, with me, Harry Mount, editor of the Oldie, and I'm delighted to be interviewing the great Roger Lewis, a very distinguished writer and a much-treasured Oldie contributor. And he has just written an absolutely terrific book, Erotic Vagrancy, Everything About Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor. And I think in that terrific book, is it right to say you reinvented the biographical form? What you tried to do with that book?
Well, the thing is, I don't really believe in biography. I've always found them terribly predictable, the way they're written, the way they're constructed. And so, years ago, even starting with my Peter Sellers book, I created a sort of labyrinthine text which was meant to evoke or mirror Peter Sellers's zigzaggy, maze-like personality. And books just, well, biographies, non-fiction, they just don't do that. We just always begin with the ancestry and the childhood and going to school and early struggles, success, maturity, illness, death, and we end with the memorial service. Every single biography you pick up is like that. So I was determined to do something new, do something different with the form.
And you certainly did, and it's a brilliant portrait of Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor separately, but also as a couple. And it's a tale of two geniuses, would you say, brought low by excess?
Well, I think they were raised to delirious heights by success and by money and by all the luxury in their lives and first-class travel and diamonds and private jets and all that wonderful, excessive 1960s existence. And I think they embodied all of that, absolutely loved it. They were domiciled in Switzerland. I don't know how often they were there, but they were theoretically domiciled in Switzerland. So they never paid any tax on their vast earnings from Hollywood. And they just loved it and spent the money and drank lots of vodka and champagne and just had a terrific time.
And you're brilliant, particularly on her money. She's terrific at making a huge amount of money out of husbands, but also out of her acting, but also out of her perfume. She makes this huge
fortune. Yes, at the end when she sort of gave up acting and she started endorsing perfumes and made millions and millions from that. More from that than from her performances. And she just became this great star. And you don't really have people of that calibre anymore, I don't think. I mean, she started out as a child actress in all those films with dogs and horses, you know, Lassie films and National Velvet, and then ended up this old broad, became a dame, and she had all her, as I say, endorsements for perfumes, which had names like sort of white diamonds and stuff. I don't know whether this stuff is still manufactured. I haven't seen any on sale. But she made a lot of money from that. And then she became a friend of Michael Jackson, which was incredibly peculiar. And she said he was the least crazy person she'd ever known or something, which sort of gives you an idea of her concept of normality.
And you're very good at studying every single film they're in, and some of them are terrible, aren't they? But actually, when you catch one of their films late at night on ITV3 or something, I think they're always utterly convincing, aren't they?
They're worth watching, aren't they?
Yeah.
Because Burton always had that Shakespearean gravitas about him. So he could elevate those corny roles. And she's always fascinating with those beautiful violet eyes of hers. So even when they're in bad films, they make them compelling.
Yes. Your other books, you're about to reissue The Life and Death of Peter Sellers, who would have been 100 on September the 8th. And he also, in that wonderful book, you're trying to get inside his character. And I think one comes away from reading that book, he was essentially crazy, wasn't he?
Yes, he was mad. He was off his head in more than a manner of speaking. And I suppose today he'd be given a diagnosis and put on pills, and he would have been medicated and calmed down, and maybe that would have destroyed the genius. And the dark side of Sellers, the tantrums, the melancholia, the way he was a sort of difficult creature, I think that becomes more apparent now when you watch the films. You can see it there. Whereas, Dr. Strangelove, he's trying to blow up the world. Lolita, when he's Claire Quilty, and that's a very sinister performance. Other performances he gave, he's a comic actor, he's not a comedian. I mean, he was a great actor. I think he's very underrated as an actor in his day. And when my book first came out in 1994, all the Goon Show fans were appalled. They just wanted merriment and hilarity and Harry Secombe giggling, you know. They thought I was really doing a hatchet job, saying that Sellers was mad and difficult and dark and depressive. But I think I was making him more interesting. And it's the Goon Show now that I think is really dated.
Yes, well, comedy does date, doesn't it? It was funny at the time, but it seems...
It's contextual.
Yes.
And it was funny in the 50s because it was all full of jokes about the war and Hitler jokes and explosions and making jokes about the officers, you know, Major Bloodnock and so on. All that's gone now. No one can relate to it.
And silly voices that don't seem funny, do they? Just putting on a high-pitched voice
isn't
funny.
And that's why Monty Python isn't very funny either.
And Peter Sellers comes across in your terrific book as being pretty unpleasant as well. Is that fair enough to say?
Well, I think so. He other people didn't really fully exist. He was the sort of centre of his own universe, and wives and children and directors and co-stars. And didn't have a full reality compared to his own. I mean, he was an absolute solipsist, egomaniac.
But it's not like he was... perhaps it was that he was imitating these people for that moment, was he? That there was no real Peter Sellers there.
There was that film Being There that he made at the end, where he plays a sort of a blank person. It was possibly quite close to how he was when he wasn't putting on voices and performing a script or being given someone else's personality to adopt and adapt. I mean, he was the sort of person, if you started talking to him, he'd start doing your accent back at you. I mean, if you see the Parkinson interview, by the end of it, Peter Sellers is Yorkshire. He's talking, you know, he becomes Parky. So when we made the film with HBO, they had this brilliant idea that Geoffrey Rush would turn into the other people in his own story. And I think they did that wonderfully. Wonderfully, wonderfully, wonderfully well. He even turns into his wife at one point. He turns into his mother and his father and all these other people. I thought that was a fascinating way of trying to explicate this crazy personality. Very schizoid.
And I was talking to Ken Cranham, the great actor, the other day, and I was talking about another actor who said how good... I said how good I thought he was. And Ken said, not to be dismissive, he just went, oh, yeah, you can do it. And it's a funny thing being able to do it, isn't it? Peter Sellers can do it, Richard Bertner can do it, Liv Taylor can do it. And then there are quite a few actors who can't do it. And do you think it's just in you, or it's something about being able to impersonate other people?
Oh, I don't think drama school is required. I mean, Shirley Temple could do it at the age of 3. So you don't really... And Elizabeth Taylor could do it early on. I don't think you learn much there, really. It's this innate ability, isn't it, to be natural and to pretend to be themselves. It's quite a complicated trick to pull off.
To go into your life and career, Roger, you were born in 1960 in South Wales.
So. Yes, I'm now elderly, but I'm not able...
Not by oldie standards.
Not by oldie standards. But actually, the joke's wearing thin, because I used to write for the oldie when I was much, much younger. And there was this huge gulf between myself and them. You know, my cousin Jeremy Lewis, for example.
Who was the deputy editor of the Aldi for many years.
Yeah, Jeremy, who was my cousin, was my father's generation. You know, so there was this... gap, but that now it's narrowed, and I'm now as venerable as everyone else. But I don't get my old age pension until next year, you know, till you're 66.
And Roger, you're extremely clever boy, but at the same time, you're extremely interested in films, and I think at a young age you started watching Peter Sellers.
Oh, yeah. I did. I loved it. I never really saw the difference between high art and Shakespeare and Milton and Beowulf and all that sort of things you study at degree level. And movies, and old movies, and television programmes. I loved all that. To me, it was all entertainment.
And actually, also, you wrote a brilliant article for The Oldie a few years ago saying that actually brilliant actors like Charles Hawtrey, for whom you wrote a brilliant biography, are more entertaining than, say, Iris Murdoch.
Oh, yes. Quite often, people that were highly esteemed when they were alive, afterwards you think, well, what was all that about? You know, and Iris Murdoch, I think, her stuff is... Sometime I reread The Sea recently, and I thought it was so bad. I didn't even understand how it found a publisher, and yet she won the Booker Prize with it. And when I was growing up, someone we all used to read in the newspapers, he was such a great columnist and journalist, Bernard Levin. If you ever read his stuff now, it's appallingly bad and verbose and not funny and forced. And you can see this stuff's being, you know, cranked out three times a week. I've been rereading Christopher Hitchens. People have, you know, very high opinion of him. And I'm not... Some of that now seems a bit laboured.
Sort of what, highfalutin, is it?
Yes.
Silly long words.
And contrarian in a contrived way. And so everyone thought Mother Teresa, Calcutta's great saintly figure, so he has to demonise her, you know. I imagine if he was alive now, he'd be saying Trump is wonderful.
Yes, yes, yeah.
Because he was pro the Iraq War, wasn't he?
When everyone else was against it. Yeah.
So there's that. And also he's rather boorish and bullying and humorous, I found, when I was reading him. And Miles Kington and Alan Corran, these newspaper humorists, it's just waste paper now.
Whereas to be funny and remain funny, would you agree that both Evelyn Waugh and Auburn Waugh, yeah, and Kingsley Amis and Philip Larkin...
Yeah, they survive.
And none of them date, because when you're funny on a higher level, it is perhaps the highest art. Mm.
They're the ones I read and reread. They're the standard, aren't they? They're the standard of writing, not just comedy writing. And the trouble is, if you have a sort of comic underthump to your work, sometimes people think, oh, well, that means you're frivolous. But I think Kingsley Amis was one of the great novelists of the 20th century, and a million times better than Martin Amis, who I can't abide.
I'd add a lot.
I just think it's pretentious.
And, Roger, going back to your career, you were a don at our old college, Magdalen College, Oxford, and at Wolfson College.
Yes, I was a junior research fellow at the age of 24 and thought that academe would be where I would remain. But I wrote a book called Stage People, which was not just swiftly remaindered by Lord Weidenfeld. I think it was pre-remaindered. It just had made no sales whatsoever. But anyway, there was a little tiny bit in there about Peter Sellers, and a publisher got in touch and said, oh, would you be, you know, do you think that you could do something on this, on Peter Sellers? And so that then became the Peter Sellers book. And the advance, this was back in the 1980s, the advance set me free from having to teach. And I found teaching and doing tutorials and the odd lecture really draining. And there was no time, there was no brain juice left to do anything else.
Because you did prepare for every single tutorial, did you?
Yes, yeah. You do. You have to, you know, you suddenly have to reread Middlemarch or something because someone from St. Hilda's wants to talk about it, you know.
But this was in the 80s when things were still pretty high-minded. I think you told me the other day that Oxford obviously is very beautiful, but it would be much better as a series of travelodges now.
Yes, it would. I think now I got no love for the place whatsoever, or indeed for English degrees. I think civilised, good-mannered, well-mannered people should read all these things anyway, so they shouldn't have to go and do courses on it. And it's all so woke now and so ridiculous. There was something in the Times yesterday about, Shakespeare's in the doghouse because it encourages the white supremacists.
Absolutely.
And there's this hatred of our traditions and our history and our rituals and ceremonies and all the things I was brought up to love and which I do love.
But when you did it, you did read, as it were, the greatest hits of English literature, and you wrote a terrific piece about your friends from school in South Wales in the 70s and 80s would have read a lot of the greatest hits of English literature.
Well, we did. In the sixth form we did, and had general studies, and people who were off to do, I don't know, dentistry or become doctors or lawyers or whatever, they would have this background in the arts. You'd see them at Welsh National Opera performances and so on. It was this broad education, and I that seems to have gone.
And Roger, you're always brilliant on the misery of the writer's life.
Oh, well, it is miserable. But it's a horrible existence. Leaving home this morning to come up to London, I noticed I've got black mould running up and down the curtains.
But at the same time, as the late Paul Bailey, the theatre critic of the Oldie, used to say, you have these multiple homes, and I believe, sorry to bring this up, but you were paid £1 million for the film of the Peter Sellers book.
No, that's absolutely not true. It was a complete lie. It was $500,000. Right. But dollars. And that was a long time ago as well.
But despite the miseries of the writer's life, you go on turning out these absolutely brilliant books. I haven't mentioned half of them, The Real Life of Laurence Olivier, your fantastic Seasonal Suicide Notes, My Life as It Is Lived, which came out in 2009.
Yeah, well,
which was very, very funny. What was the origin of that book?
Well, I was told recently, oh, well, that would never come out today. You know, it belongs to a world that is gone. I'm not allowed to say all these, make all these jokes and be rude about people. But the origin was every Christmas we'd get these, well, we all get them, these round robins. Well, no, people don't send them to me anymore. But we get these round robins where people are very boastful about their children's exam successes, their holidays in the villa in Tuscany, piano lesson successes and concerts that they were off to see all the time. And very boastful, people sort of talking about their year. And I thought, well, my life isn't at all like this, and my children aren't even fairly competent on the recorder. So I thought I'd write the reality of it, and I'd send these out to people, and then someone said, well, you could gather these up as a little book, which I did. And it had wonderful coverage and reviews, and people loved it, but it never made me any money. I think the publishers were...
It was a bestseller, wasn't it?
Paradoxically, a bestseller that didn't make the author any royalties. So I don't know where it all went. Because people like, Sharon Osbourne would say to me, oh, I bought 9 copies. And Molly Parkin, she said, it was what I gave everyone for Christmas. So anyway, there we are. I think in 2010 I received a cheque for £2,000, I think. And that was about it.
Unbelievable.
Well.
Roger, one of the consolations of the writer's life and the journalist's life, you're a terrific journalist, is often meeting your heroes. You knew the great Barry Humphreys very well, and the great Barry Cryer, who would have been 90 this weekend.
Yes, and Barry Humphreys died just before he was 90, wasn't it? 89.
Yes.
So they were very venerable figures, and it was absolute pleasure knowing those fellows, and particularly I was very proud and pleased to be on Barry Cryer's phone list. So every week or so he'd phone up with some jokes and a chat, or if he spotted an article in the Oldie or the Mail or wherever that he'd enjoyed, he'd phone up with a sort of equivalent of a pat on the back, which is really nice, is what we need.
Yes, he was very kind. At the tribute evening he had, Stephen Fry said, a great friend of yours said, the thing is, most comedians are complete bastards. The funny thing about Barry was he very, very kind
he
man.
He was. Yeah. He really was. And he enjoyed other people's success as well. And he was a genuinely nice person. And as you say, the comedians tend not to be. I mean, not as an extreme example, Peter Sellers, with all his lunacy. But people like Spike Milligan, you know, you'd never know whether he'd be nice to you or nasty, or whether he'd be warm or whether he'd be irascible.
And was very aggressive to Barry Cryer. Barry told the story against himself that on meeting Spike Milligan put his hands up against the wall and said, "Oh, go, take all my jokes. Here's Barry Cryer, the great joke stealer," which is, you know, no copyright in a joke.
Well, it'd be cruel. And a lot of comedians are cruel, and they often don't like laughing at other people's jokes either. They refuse to find things funny. I think Tommy Cooper was probably quite a surly person, or, you know, in reality, as it were, wherever that realm might be. But Barry Humphries and I mean, he was like one of my closest friends, and I really miss him. I mean, often seeing things or think things, like, I'd love to tell Barry this, and he's, you know, not there. Rather like a father figure.
Yes. But and he was, I talked to him at the Oldie when he had a lovely column there, talking on such a high plane, not to show off Iris Murdoch style how clever he was, but he was so witty and so quick right up to his death. It's not wrong to use the word genius of him.
Oh, he was absolute genius, yes. And recently there was the sale of some of his pictures and books, and, you know, he collected all his Oscar Wilde first editions and manuscripts and things, and all the Charles Condor paintings and so on was all sold, and about 5 million or something. And this was just a tiny sample of
There's
all.
Another one next week, in fact, Druids of more of his books,
of his
extraordinary
stuff.
Oscar Wilde books.
Wonderful things he'd collected, and he really knew all this stuff. He wasn't just buying it all as an investment. I mean, he really knew his way around English literature in the 1890s in particular. I mean, he's a real scholar, and he'd know all these really obscure people, and I sometimes try and find something that he might not know about. So there was this writer called Marmaduke Pickford, and I mentioned this to him once, and he said, "Oh yes, I own some of his manuscripts," which is true. Is he? He'd go into a bookshop and he'd say, "Oh, have you got any Lofcadio Hearn?" And Lofcadio Hearn, someone wrote about Japan and things, and it was just wonderful and funny and a bit camp as well.
Yes.
Because he was, wasn't he, with all his purple fedoras.
Yes,
and
that was all playing
suits.
Up. I wonder what that was. That was sort of a love of beautiful things, do you think it
yes,
was?
Yes, yeah. There was that. And he also did his absolute best, Barry Humphries did, to carry on living as if he was in 1890. I mean, he was like Henry Irving at the Lyceum, wasn't he, with the sort of grand actor manager. Or he could have been Vincent Crummles in Nicholas Nickleby. So he was always playing a role. And even in when he was talking about books or pictures, or again, that was a role he was playing.
Yes, how interesting, yes. And also standing back at one remove from everything, because he was so funny. So you'd be having a conversation with him and then he'd drop in a secondary remark which was just on a higher level and extremely witty. You like Barry Cryer, extremely good judge of what makes people funny, and Barry Cryer would say some people just had funny bones. In fact, he said both Tommy Cooper had funny bones and Eric Morecambe did, but actually, in fact, there's a new play on called The Last Laugh, with characters playing Eric Morecambe, Tommy Cooper and Bob Monkhouse.
Who's
not funny, yeah.
Bob Monkhouse is not funny. I mean, he was a great technician of comedy. He was a great scholar of comedy, and he thought about it and talked about it. But in himself, he was not funny. That's my problem, really, with the Monty Python troupe. I mean, I think the genius there is Terry Gilliam. But the rest of them are like accountants or bank managers sort of acting the giddy goat at some end of the year party. I don't think they're really funny people. They're good writers, and I mean, Michael Palin is a superb TV presenter, but otherwise, they're not, in themselves, they're not funny, no.
And do you think that's a thing that you're just born with, that let's say the 10-year-old Barry Humphries would have had it?
Oh, yes. Even photos of Barry when he was a child, he's funny. He's dressed up as, a pirate or in a sailor suit or something. He's always in costume. I mean, all the time he was. It's like that question you might be asked in an exam. How do you know when an actor is acting? Well, with people like Barry, there was no beginning or no end to it. The same with Laurence Olivier. It was a masquerade from beginning to end.
Roger, in many ways, we're very lucky to have you here on Radio Aldi, but particularly since we very nearly lost you in 2023 in a Morrison supermarket in Hastings. Can you explain what happened there?
Yes, I can. I find it more frightening now, actually, than at the time. Because at the time, you deal with things. It's only afterwards you think, Christ, you know. But anyway, I hadn't been feeling that well for a few days, but suddenly the air was sucked out of me. And I obviously collapsed, because the next thing I knew, I was on my way to Morrison's to do the shopping, and the next thing I knew, there were these sort of bearded men staring down at me, who were the paramedics. So I'd been out for camp for a few minutes, of which I have no recollection whatsoever, so I was actually technically dead for a few minutes, and they were doing all the CPR, and then someone came running out with a defibrillator, and then an ambulance came, and I was wheeled onto that, and then wheeled to the park. The air ambulance helicopter was there, which took me to hospital. And they inserted a stent, and it was all very dramatic and terrifying for my wife and children, who were all there waiting in that little room. You know, that they had that little room, and you're waiting for news.
Horrible.
Like on Casualty or something. And I was there, and the worst thing afterwards for me was this agony, because all my ribs were smashed from the CPR.
Yes.
After that, after about 6 weeks, that abated, and just got on with life, because I had the erotic vagrancy to do the copy editing and the proofreading and bringing that out. But I wasn't able to do much publicity for it, and I wasn't well enough for that. So that was most of that year disappeared. And then here we are now, and I look back, and I'm more fearful and more anxious as a result.
Although, Roger, you've written a brilliant piece in the New Oldie saying you're taking a new health regime very, very seriously.
Yes.
Including you only have a unit a day, but by one unit you mean one bottle.
Well, I thought that's what it meant. I thought that was the advice. And also dry January to me means, dry sherry, dry martinis, dry cider. No, I can't really be doing with the health zealotry. I can't be bothered with that. And jogging and running and exercise, it just makes my spirit sink.
You did give up drink for a bit, didn't you?
I did. Well, on one occasion I gave it up for 7.5 years, and then nearly died of boredom. And socialising and parties are hopeless, because people get away from you. So Barry Humphries gave it up. I mean, from the early 1970s, I mean, he never drank again. But Barry's like a dry drunk, strangely. He always seemed as if he was a bit tipsy, didn't he?
Yes, and was always seeming to enjoy himself, but also capable of constant wit and amusement.
Yeah, I wonder whether he exchanged one addiction for another, and that's why he bought so many millions of books and pictures and so on. It was compulsive. I mean, Lizzie was saying, wasn't she, his widow, that she had to stop him from buying things, and he was sort of sneakily buying things and hiding them in the wardrobe.
I think also it's a cliche, but an addiction to performing. He said during lockdown he was absolutely miserable because he couldn't.
Yes, he was, and the last time I saw him, he was doing this one-man show. And then he was in Australia again, and he wrote to me saying this scanner machine, as invented by the same firm that funded the rise of Adolf Hitler, and discovered all these tumours in his spine. So he went into hospital because he'd fallen over and broken his hip or something, but then they found all kinds of other things, and he never came out. And so he used to email me a lot. And there's a lot. Well, I did a little collection of the messages, didn't I, for the magazine? Yeah.
Eddie Roger, well, thank God you're still with us, writing
for the
brilliant Art of the Oldie,
absolutely
terrific book, Erotic Vagrancy, everything about Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor. Roger Lewis, thanks so much for appearing on Radio Oldie.
Well, thank you, Harry. Been a pleasure.
You have been listening to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Why not get 3 trial issues of the Oldie magazine for just £1? Sure you'll enjoy it. We'll then charge you £25.75 for every 6 issues. Just go to checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial as one word in capitals. That's checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial.